Hi, this is Andrew Mayer, and you're listening to the Active Design Podcast. Today I have Jason Bice. He's a brand strategist at Landor. Not a game designer, as we've been talking to so far, but we're branching out into some other interactive media. So, Jason, welcome.
Oh, thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Sure, glad to have you here. So why don't you tell people about what the brand strategist, what you do for a living. I think, to my mind, it's a little bit sort of like a job that you kind of find hard to believe is actually real.
Oh, yeah. It is. It's weird because there's two camps when you discuss brand. And a lot of people kind of look at brand as either kind of a lot of smoke and mirrors that maybe may or may not be necessary, and then there's the group that kind of really considers it as a driver of consumer loyalty or customer preference and things like that. The discipline that I work within and where I started out is in what we used to call naming and writing, and it's become more of a verbal strategy kind of holding tank. So we've got a bunch of different types of brain in there. One of the main responsibilities I have is my client is a very large original equipment manufacturer, not Apple, and what I do is I name devices. So I started out about 5 years ago, and things were pretty different in the handheld device category. A lot of it was all cell phones. We hadn't hit the smartphone revolution, so to speak, quite yet. So you had a lot of different things going on in the space. And form factor and the design of the device itself drove a lot of what you would name the device. And
because back then we're talking like 2000. So one thing I wanted to point out was like this is the devices that you name are things that would be in a lot of people's pockets. I mean, they're fairly major. They're sold at a lot.
Most everybody's pockets.
I mean,
pockets,
they're smartphones, yeah. Right? So they're devices that if they're not Apple devices, they're in a lot of people's pockets, and they're in a lot of the phone provider stores.
Absolutely, yeah, yeah.
You couldn't really walk into an AT&T store and not see something that you had named.
Yeah, you can't walk into any of those stores and not see something that has a name that I've created or the group that I work with has created.
And you started doing that. You said in 2007 you started working for these companies.
I started working in 2008, and I started doing that in 2008, and so the form factor was a big deal, and part of what spurred like having to name devices was, I mean, prior to, I guess, the big two that I tend to cite the most is the LG Chocolate and the Motorola Razr.
Razr, I remember being a big deal.
Right. So Razr obviously was a super thin phone, right? And Chocolate looked like a candy bar, and henceforth, we call devices that are that shape candy bars.
Right.
As a general moniker at this
right.
point.
Right, right.
It was the first time that anybody had ever really seen sales be affected by a name. Because prior to that, a lot of devices were just alphanumeric. You'd have the Motorola R280 or something like that.
The Nokia, yeah,
right.
540, whatever, yeah.
And phones, by and large, were just crappy. You got it and you knew it was going to, it's going to be kind of a poor, phone experience. And you didn't have the real web. You had this mobile internet. I don't know if anybody remembers what that was like. It was horrible.
Although, what's interesting is that, I had the only way I was able to get internet service on the morning of 9/11 was via tethering through my StarTAC.
Oh my God.
I actually had a cable. That was 2001, and I was actually able to like, drive some webs. I mean, it was slow. It was probably like equivalent to a 2400 baud modem or something.
Amazing.
Like that. But that morning, I was like, they weren't charging extra for tethering back then either.
I was still living in Japan at the time, and the phones there were like way, way, way far ahead what people had in the U.S. And I was like a one man Twitter at the time, where I was actually providing my folks and the people that I know with updates because I was seeing it on the news in real time over there, and people were just waking up.
And then what were you pushing that through, do you remember?
I had one of those really ruggedized Casio. It was like, I think it was called like a G's One or
and
something.
You're emailing it to people? How are you
emailing? But I actually had this tiny little circular screen, and this is the one that you could like drop into a glass of beer and like pull out, and it was totally fine. And I did have
no longer a service offered on almost any device.
No, not at all. You can you can't drop it 2 inches without having something happen. But I had limited access to what was the mobile web, but it was much better and much speedier because they were on packet data back then, and I think that's changed in Japan now. But anyway, I mean, I was able to get news, and I was able to, and I was sitting, in a restaurant watching the news happen, and so it was kind of crazy.
Yeah, I mean, I was, not to get too far down this rabbit hole, but I was in New York that morning, and so almost all of our service went down.
Yeah,
because everything was in the towers. All the mm-hmm. wiring was in the towers. So anyway, so we're down. Now we're in 2008, right? I mean, I think it's. It's funny. I just wrote a piece on a little while back on Sony on the next generation of consoles,
mm-hmm.
and we're looking at 6 years. And I went back, and when the console started out, there was no Apple Store because mm-hmm. there was no iPhone, there was no right. Facebook, so there were no apps, mm-hmm. and there was none of that. So like that whole ecosystem, everything that we've seen, all that change has happened in the last half decade. It's mm-hmm. been pretty because I think the iPhone came out in 2007.
Yeah. Yeah, and as soon as that took hold, I mean, that really changed a lot of things because either you had an iPhone or you just did not.
So were you guys? So you were there. You were working for this company the day. It was the year after.
It was the year after. So you were still really new. Living in San Francisco, of course, everybody had one in their pocket right away. I had actually had just gotten the job at Landor, and was still. Still a bit poor from coming off of my other job.
So what were you doing before? Because
this is a crazy, crazy, crazy story. I was managing restaurants, and I was working for this horrible, gigantic Frankenfood company called McCormick & Schmick's, which was, I shouldn't say Frankenfood, but it was just, it's just a crazy, huge chain of kind of like, seafood, and sometimes steak. But anyway, I was managing.
Was a restaurant chain.
Yeah, and okay. I was managing the McCormick and Coletto's in Girardelli Square, which is actually how I ended up here. I was transferred from Portland, which is the home office over there, and I was managing the Harborside restaurant in Portland. Opportunity came up, and who doesn't want to move to San Francisco when you get offered a way to go there for free? Because I had vacationed here, and a lot of my friends from college are from the area. You think about it all the time, but it's like you can't move without a job if you're coming to San Francisco.
Well, right, it's hard to get out of Portland also because Portland has got, it's a lot more expensive here, right?
Yeah, and Portland is Portland's a unique vortex. It's a beautiful, it's, I wonder, I forget who, I forget if it was, what was it, F. Scott Fitzgerald in Great Gatsby, called All Girls a Pretty Trap. Portland's a pretty trap in that aspect. But anyway, it was an opportunity that we just couldn't pass up. So we were there, and it was just restaurant management in general is just like this horrible soul sucking experience. You have no time to yourself, and everybody hates you. The customers hate you. Your staff hates you, and everybody you do your best to do good by everybody, but eventually it gets to be really emotionally taxing. And the time came where it was just like, I can't do this anymore. I'm not seeing my wife. I'm not seeing anybody. But I really didn't know. I really didn't know what I needed to do to get myself out and do something else. But it's weird. Like, everybody's life journey is different. One of the regulars at the place owned an art gallery, and I had mentioned in passing because we were just fellow geeks who we were trading episodes of. Oh God, what is it? It's the one set in London. I forget what it is now. And the guy's immortal. And
not Doctor Who.
No, not Doctor Who. Oh man.
Set in London. Oh, you mean the was it a miniseries?
Yeah, kind of.
Not the Jekyll one, right?
No. Okay. Anyway. So we were watching that, and we were trading episodes of this thing, and we were using an old iPod as our means of exchange, and I had to get it back to him. He had one of the original ones, and I mentioned in passing, like, hey, I'm quitting. This job sucks, and if you need someone to sweep your floors, be happy to do it for minimum wage. And he was more than happy to say, no, actually you can come and sell art at my gallery, which is not what I wanted to do, but it was like, well, I have an opportunity to earn money while I'm trying to figure out my life, which was
right.
really good.
Right.
Your life is really on the hamster wheel when you work in hospitality, and you don't realize like how how little time you've had to think about yourself or your life or anything. Because day in and day out, it's like these 14-hour shifts, and then, you know, and it, you either, you know, you go drink or you go to sleep or you go do whatever it is that you do, but you're basically getting up an hour or two again before your shift.
Right.
So this time that I spent at the gallery, I spent a lot of time either dealing with, you know, prospective customers came in, but there was a lot of downtime too. I spent a lot of time researching the marketing industry and talking to people. And doing the whole like swallow your pride and like reach out and really try to network and just email everybody that you know. And in about a year, I kind of figured, you know, like I really need to kind of boost myself into something that felt a little bit more along the lines of what I was able to do. And as a person who tends to write a lot, I had always envisioned myself, you know, doing the same thing everybody envisions themselves doing, right? You know, writing the great American novel, but wanted to get paid to write as
right,
well.
Right, that's a tough.
So
greater otherwise, it's tough to be a writer these days.
Oh man, it's ridiculous, and it's harder now than it's ever been, I think.
Well, harder and easier, right? Because of self-publishing.
Easier to get out there, right? But I think it's harder to get. You know, I think good content is tough to come by. I think that's right. The thing is, like, we're saturated with so many things to read.
I mean, finding your audience is tough. I mean, one of the things I was having a discussion with a friend of mine about, actually Rafi, the guy who's on the pilot episode of the podcast. Talking about this thing Homestuck that he just can't wrap his head around. I don't know if you've heard of it. It's sort of like post internet anime.
Oh, cool.
It's not narrative really. But it's basically months and months of single panel or two panel stories, and then he does an amazing he'll do an amazing 3-minute animation at the end.
Oh wow.
But it's bigger than a lot of it's got a bigger audience at some cons than anime does now. He's got a huge following, this guy.
Amazing.
And my friend was freaking out about how unhappy he is about the size of the audience. It's found out because he doesn't get why people are into it. And I think one opportunity that we really have now is that if you put a pile of stuff together, if you make enough stuff and it's of decent quality, you'll find an audience, you know, that matches. You know, somewhere. If you put, and obviously with marketing and networking, you can do a little bit more. But
yeah.
But anyway, so you're at the place and you're researching marketing. And
so lo and behold,
you're looking to write.
Well, one of my coworkers' wife is head of HR for Landor Associates at the time, and he had stepped out for something. I don't know if we needed packaging materials or whatever, but she brought lunch to share with him one day, and he wasn't around, so. We had lunch together, struck up a conversation, and then probably around 4 or 5 months later, she contacted me and said, "Hey, are you interested in coming to work with us?" And I, of course, was. And from there, you know, it's kind of, you know, just kind of kismet. Like I entered and started working, and so in that time, kind of cultivated and shaped, because Landor is a really organic type experience once you're inside. So you really have to kind of push and direct the way that you. What you want to become and what you want to work on and what the deliverables are going to be and what they're going to become, because you can easily fall back into that large corporate branding model where you recycle your deliverables and you cut and paste a lot of stuff.
How big a company are they?
We're pretty large. We're the global headquarters, but there's offices in Cincinnati, New York, Beijing, Shanghai. It's global.
And it's all marketing. It's all marketing.
Yeah, it's all brand driven. It's all marketing. Different offices handle different types of deliverable. Although we ostensibly all can handle, you know, each one of the same, you know, each one of those things on our own. For example, there's, you know, some parts of the office will handle more like consumer packaged goods and things. So you know, there's traditional, like really, really straight traditional design and stuff where you're doing packages and cans and labels, and then there's some of the more hands-on kind of nitty-gritty strategic stuff like brand architecture and, you know, nomenclature systems for, you know, just either internal or external, for example. And, you know, this is, you know, not a real thing, but like if a large, you know, software company wanted you to figure out how to put a structure to all the electronics that they sell, you know, and you have a nomenclature structure for that. And that could be boring. That could be like, okay, well, everything's going to lead with the letter A if it's a printer, and it's going to be a C if it's, you know, if it's a scanner or something like that.
Like an Epson kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. And it can be pretty dry, but it can
and
be...
And opaque, really, a lot of times to the users, too, right?
Right.
Like, one thing I've noticed is the big shift now is the that, you know, I don't know what I have, like, an, you know, my printer is still like an Epson NC,
yeah,
whatever. I mean, they never got around to actually branding those in a way that compels anybody to do
exactly anything. But to somebody on the inside, it's very specific to them.
Well,
finally we have a way to categorize
it. Great when you have 5,000 drop downs for the printer to figure out what driver you're supposed to be installing, right?
Printers are one of those things that I'm not sure that are ever going to work, you know, the way that they're supposed to work all the time. But
it's a whole nother because they're in the ink business, right? Not the printer business. So mm-hmm. That's another.
Yeah.
I mean, I, you know, this new one I have is completely wireless. It has not a single hole in it except for the one that the power goes into.
That's good.
So it's interesting to, and the worst interface, like, there's nothing more humbling than the moment that you have a device where you're entering some kind, when you're entering a password for your internet with a four-way keyboard, you know, a four-way joypad interface, and you're like, man, is this, you know, it's like I remember when I, you know, I kept, it's funny, I mean, it still hasn't stopped, right? Like, every time there's a new device out, you end up back in the world of 2D and 8, like 16-bit pixels, right?
Yeah.
And like, now it's almost like an art form on the iPhone, right? Mm-hmm. With all these pixelated games, but like, you know, and so it's like you keep thinking that you're moving forward, and then when the new platform emerges, like, you end up going back. I mean, I remember on phones,
yeah.
I did games for Game Boy Color,
mm-hmm.
and like the games on the phones were even, like, you know, were worse.
Yeah.
Right. The color was a nightmare to work for you. If you had 8 sprites in a row, they would start to flicker.
Oh god.
The phone wasn't even that good. So anyway, sorry. So we're going back. We're talking about Landor, and I don't want to keep calling them Libor, but that's not good. Landor, and then so you got in there, and you were working in they were obviously worldwide branding.
Yeah. So
huge.
essentially, you know, I cut my teeth on a few projects, and we had this naming discipline, and the client. At the time, you know, it's like we started out really small. There was a period of time where I think, you know, the portfolio that we were entitled to work with, because obviously they had tons of phones to name, right? But I think we got like 12 one year. And then the next year, it was like, that's great. We really like this. This is cool. And then the next year in like 2009, I think there was like 32. And then in 2010, there was like 71. I mean, it just skyrocketed.
Right.
And part of that is the evolution of you know, the evolution of the technology, the evolution of the industry, and basically the evolution of the devices themselves, right? Because we started to start not just doing like handsets, it was going to be tablets, and it was going to be, you know, consumer electronics, peripherals, accessories, and things like that. So
I mean, I don't think anybody even 3 or 4 years ago really understood the impact that the market was going to have on everything, right?
Well,
I mean,
it's amazing.
I don't even know. I mean, I say that sitting here, you know, one of the fundamental things about this podcast, one of the reasons I started these conversations, is because I don't think we really understand the impact at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I think if anybody thinks, you know, I think it's clearer in games because we've really hit a point where nobody knows what's happening next,
mm-hmm.
for a variety of reasons. But I think in technology in general, we've reached this point of like, everybody wants to make an app,
mm-hmm.
but it's not the same as making some, you know, there's a lot of fundamental differences in the way that apps are created and the way
mm-hmm.
On these platforms than has ever been done before.
Well, it's kind of like the social media thing, like when social media was brand new. It's like everybody knew that they needed to get out there and be on it. They didn't really know what they wanted to do with it or how they were going to direct that communication or how they were going to sound or what they were going to talk about. And some brands ended up doing it really well, and some brands really just kind of flopped or just had a presence. Now, you know, transfer that now to people starting to, you know, I say that very, very loosely, starting to manage those identities a little bit better. But now it's the app thing. It's like everybody needs an app. Everybody needs an interactive module. Everybody needs something that helps communicate to the customer what, you know, what this new widget thing that we do is. And that can be exceptionally useful when it's well thought out and that is what you need. Because, you know, I constantly see myself or hear myself saying this to clients and to people. It's like, do you really need an app, or do you really just need a mobile version of your website? Because everybody's going to the main site on their phones, and they got these tiny little screens, and they're, you know, and I'll say, like, even something like the Samsung Note has a huge screen, but it's still, if you don't have a mobile version of your site, then you're doing everybody a disservice, right?
Oh, well, yeah.
So do you need an app, or do you need something, a better way to interact with your consumer?
I mean,
right?
Right. I mean, that's a big question that we've had over the last couple of years generally, right? Which is that, you know, in terms of destination websites, I mean, I've downloaded a lot of apps from companies. Well, I mean, Facebook, they just, there was a period, I mean, we're talking weeks or months, but you couldn't change, I think you fixed it in the latest version, but you could change your cover photo mm-hmm. on the website version, mm-hmm. on the mobile version, but not on the app.
Yeah. Which and that was only, a couple weeks back, right?
Yeah, a couple weeks ago. Yeah. But it's been interesting to see like that, having to fork and run two different versions.
Mm-hmm.
I think the only company that's really on top. I mean, it's a longer conversation, and I want to get back to sort of your story
mm-hmm.
before we get too far off of it. But the appification of the web and like what this means, and it goes both ways, right? It's like you can ask that question, like, wouldn't you rather have an app? But the other question at the end of that is, rather have a web presence, which I think mm-hmm. you have to, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean. I'm in the process of rebuilding the AndrewPMayer.com site, both to handle the podcast, but also the fact that the theme that I had made 2 years ago doesn't have a mobile version.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So, I've got to look seriously now because I tried to load it the other day and I ended up putting too many headers on it and it didn't render properly.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody actually emailed me and said, hey, your website isn't rendering.
Mm-hmm.
So when you get down to the bones of it, that's the one thing I think that it is. It's what these, if you're not directed and you don't have a strategy, you end up sort of like trying to figure out like how am I going to check all these boxes across all these things, and the mm-hmm. problem is there's a new box every day,
mm-hmm.
right? There's the Android version, there's the iPhone version, there's the web, the mobile web version, there's the full web presence, there's the Facebook page, right? There's an infinite number of platforms that you have to have a strategy for, and I think if you don't have a general idea of what it is that you're trying to do with your product.
Yeah, and I think that's a problem that kind of spans across the board, because getting your arms and your head around that. So what we run into constantly is those would actually be different disciplines and different people handling those things. There's not one person who sits and says, hey, we need to do this, and this. So Facebook has some really strict design standards on we can't implement our presence through Facebook. It's not a MySpace page, right?
Right.
But then also we do need to make an Android version for the site, and we also need to make sure that this renders properly on at this point now, how many different screen sizes do we have on tablets? I think there's like 7 or 8 different types of screen size you have on tablets, laptops and what have you, and that's actually a bunch of different people making those decisions and thinking about those things,
mm-hmm.
and they often don't talk to one another,
right?
And so you'll run into this thing where you want somebody to consider, like, have you thought about this? Have you considered this? It's like, well, we're off and running, so we got to get this done. How do we, and so it goes beyond the prettiness of designing a good logo or having an intricate system of identity elements, right, that get to pop up everywhere.
So you're saying brand can be, you're sort of looking at brand as a way to hold together the choices that you're making across all the different platforms.
Kind of, but I mean, I think we're kind of entering a phase of just as the enjoyment of, anytime you do something, for example, let's take Foursquare, for example, and that's like, one of the ultimate like kind of gamified app type experiences, right? Part of the enjoyment of that is actually the metagame itself, right? Is this that I'm enjoying the activity
being
of doing
mayor,
this.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. Being the mayor, checking in or showing somebody, hey, look at, I'm in, Charles de Gaulle Airport, or whatever.
Right.
But the metagame is a very intrinsic portion of your enjoyment of this, right? But I think that you're entering a phase of kind of the meta brand too, where it's not necessarily about messaging matrices or communication touch points or, actually what you, even what you're selling, what you're doing, it's who you are and how you are experienced by the consumer. So, for example, one thing that you can do is have
so let's back up for a second. When you say who you are, you mean you as the brand or you as the user?
You as the user.
Okay.
So if it's a uniform, comfortable experience all the way across the board, then I think that you subconsciously integrate that into something that's like, oh, I can trust this, or they've checked all the boxes and things. And so it doesn't necessarily all have to be about check out this new thing that we do. It does have to be like, hey, your experience of this is going to be consistent across the board on every single, on every single touch point. So you have something, for example, and I'm not sure if they do this particularly well or not. I think they probably do something like the Gap, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is though, when I go to experience the gap.com or the application, or I go into one of their stores and I look at the environment that's been designed for me, it's the Gap. I know exactly what it is. I know exactly what I'm getting, and I trust kind of what I'm going to receive. And I also, you know, by the same token, I know what I'm not going to get. So when I'm there and I, you know, I'm not going to find a three-piece fitted suit, you know, but I'm not there for that. So I don't have to worry about those things. And I know that nobody's going to push that on me. Right. But as I'm in there, what I'm experiencing as far as I coined the term meta brand is that I'm actually taking part in a lifestyle experience when I go in there. Like I am, you know, going to go in there a Gap person. I don't go in dressed, you know, shabbily. I go in there dressed kind of like the way that I want to, you know, like, right. I want to look the part as well. And I think that, you know, when you have everybody kind of hitting those touch points all together at the same time, and this moves so far away from what like traditional marketing, you know, is, I mean, it's still part of it. Right. But, you know, instead of saying like we want, you know, these end caps on the rack to communicate lively fun. Right. They're actually having you go in there and just enjoy the shopping experience. And that's part of, you know, so I'm having fun. I'm not necessarily being advertised to, because I think our, you know, our marketplace and the consumer, we have these, you know, these BS sensors that are, you know, much more powerful than any Geiger counter. You know, it's like if you're being sold to, because we are constantly being bombarded with advertising and messages and things that, and now they're all customized and stored on our devices so that you can point the ads that they think you want, right?
Right. So, well, that's the Google infrastructure, right?
Exactly.
That's the thing. Like they're willing to wire the social web as long as they, you know, with our preferences, as long as we're willing to give them our preferences and access.
Absolutely. Absolutely. But we've become expert at filtering because of this. Like we've filtered through all that crap, and it's funny to me because of, you know, one of the side effects of this is I can always tell what project I was working on most recently by the ads that get shown to me when I browse. So
right,
I was working for
this is the thing, right? Like the right now anyway, this stuff isn't predictive yet. It's follow on, and it's like, you know, hey, I just bought the thing you think you're trying to sell.
Right.
And that's why you're trying to sell it to me, and I don't want another one.
Yeah, I just got it. So I was doing a project for a vineyard and trying to name a new wine. And it's funny because you can tell that it's doing a pretty good job of guessing what you might want. So you get a bunch of wine ads, but then, you know, like on, you know, later on the day on Wednesday, it's just like, are you an alcoholic?
Oh, yeah.
Do you need help? You know, you're like, why am I getting these ads all of a sudden?
The question is like,
because I spent my week researching alcohol.
Right. I mean, the question is, right, it's like, is it a crude, are we, it's how I feel about the drones, right? Are we happy or sad that it's crude right now?
Mm-hmm.
Because like, it won't be crude forever, mm-hmm. right? Like it will be, like we've already seen this stuff with the stuff that, that Target was able to do with the predict, you know about that stuff?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've heard about it.
The predictive mm-hmm. stuff, yeah. And, you know, I mean, it's been a big impact for me because big data is, you know, the ability for big data to give us feedback on people is really fundamentally already changed the gaming space. I mean, I think that for video games, I don't think people understand yet that it's big data in a lot of ways that and metrics in a lot of ways that have already changed the game space beyond recognition.
Yeah.
And so we have a lot of people hanging on who want to really talk about, you know, big games and console games and all that stuff, and we still have big hits occasionally, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, hopefully we'll be talking to some folks who make those games, but and about what's coming next, but like big data's it's already changed the world of entertainment,
mm-hmm.
because for that, it's like I'm helping you make a choice that has no consequences except for mm-hmm. your time, and you've already decided to spend that time,
mm-hmm.
right? I think if you're buying clothes or something else, there's a lot more vertical.
Well, you know, some of that stuff is, you know, for example, my wife, like, shopping is fun. Like, she enjoys it. To be honest, I don't like it. I've got a very finite tolerance level for how much I can shop, and it frustrates her because I'll go in, I'll buy, I know what size I am, I'll go in and buy the three things that I like and we'll leave, and it's like that's it. You know, like you don't want to look around, you don't want to try things on. It's like, no, that's a hassle. So now data is able to, you know, quantify what my habits are, right, and make these things. So okay, so I'm not one of those people that fits into the demographic of shopping enjoyer, right? So maybe I shop because I need to get the job done, and there are ways that, you know, especially because, you know, I fit into the type that would probably shop more often online than would actually enter into a bricks and mortar type, you know, establishment,
mm-hmm.
because it's easier and that convenience. And so, you know, what they've probably collected on me at this point is to show me the things that I'm likely to buy, get me in and out of there. And if you don't have a cart that gets me out within two or three clicks, I'm out. You know, I will disengage. And you know that they measure all this stuff.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You know, and everybody's asking the question, you know, if you see a disengage on the back end and somebody's asking, like, why did he do that? What happened? What, you know, where did we lose this? And then they make it into something, for example, you know, brilliant, but also very dangerous to your wallet is Google's or Amazon's one click, right?
Right.
And that is something that is just genius, is that, okay, cool, I want this, click, it's bought, I'm done.
Well, I mean, Amazon's been really, really good, right? I can look, because I know that I have the Prime in there already, mm-hmm. I'll often shop, you know, what's the term in the real world? Where you shop at a place, but then you buy on Amazon.
Showrooming,
right? Mm-hmm. But I'll do that on the web too, because mm-hmm. I know that with the built-in, if I can find a good price and I know that I'm already getting my delivery built in, like mm-hmm. why, you know, I'm locked in and they have my information. Mm-hmm. I know that the receipt's going to come to the right place.
Yep.
Like it's, you know, it's sort of pseudo standardized, right?
Oh yeah.
I'm actually surprised. Well, you know, Yahoo tried it, right? There was those mm-hmm. Yahoo stores for a while.
Yeah.
It just always, the problem is that, you know, at some point somebody has to be willing to take response. If you want to do a brand like that, if you want to pull together a meta brand like the Yahoo stores tried to be, then somebody has to what's the word I'm looking for? Somebody has to be taking responsibility for that transaction,
mm-hmm.
right? And that's the nice thing about Amazon is there's support,
mm-hmm.
and there's, you know, that you can reach a human being at the end of the day.
Oh, and they've made that very important, right? Because that
it's a huge advantage.
When you reach out, that's the one time where you don't want to have, you know, like basically no human interference, right? So if I'm online, like the one thing that makes me nuts these days is everybody building in this thing. If I wait too long, if I dawdle too long on a site, I get that pop-up box like, would you like to chat about, you know, whatever,
right,
you
right.
know? And it's on everything from like TurboTax to, it's on, I do a lot of image procurement, so it's on Getty, you know, and it's, and if I just sit there and I think about it, you know, like, do I want this shot of a sunset or this shot of a sunset? And I sit there and wait and like, oh crap, 43 seconds has gone by. They're going to nag me to chat about something. That makes me nuts because it's like, okay, I get that you're trying to predict what I want but just because I pause doesn't mean I'm necessarily confused. So when Amazon says, hey, there's going to be a person here for you, and they're not doing that to you, I think that's brilliant because that is exactly what it's meant to do.
Well, you know, once they have the eye tracking in, then they'll be able to, like, figure out what you're doing, and you'll never have to worry about that again. They'll just know everything. I knew somebody who actually was working on, I don't know how it ended up with him, but he was working on some early tracking software.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, that's the Google Glasses thing ultimately, too, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it's, you know, do you have, if you have something that can be processed in the world in real time, you know, where does then, you know, the phrase I always think of is the panopticon is complete. Like there's, you never know when you're being filmed. You never know when you're being seen. You never know, you know, you've lost that sense of innate privacy in that, you don't know the event. You can't tell what other people are doing. As bad as the phones are now,
mm-hmm.
right? I mean, it's funny. People talk about, as bad as the phones are now, I think that we're going to miss the days when we could see people looking at their devices in order to get information from mm-hmm. them. Because mm-hmm. I don't believe that the experience, and I've been thinking about this a lot, Andreessen and one of the big VCs just put out a huge, they're going to be funding, I don't know, $10 million or something. I don't know what the number is of, mm-hmm. of Google Glasses apps.
Oh, wow.
So that just dropped today. But, you know, I don't think that the fundamental, you know, just thinking about it from a design point of view, from an interactive design point of view, I don't think that the fundamental experience of that is going to be as intrusive, but mm-hmm. I think the apps will quickly get to the point where they'll be able to provide you information in a way that won't take all your attention.
Right.
Right? Like motion or color or anything mm-hmm. like that, secondary experiences. Mm-hmm. I mean, we do that, we're processing that data all the time anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a feeling that if once you have something that's painting over the real world instead of a separate experience,
mm-hmm.
it's going to quickly be a lot more subtle and maybe pernicious than we think. I mean, mm-hmm. I hate to be totally negative, but you know, it's easy to. I will say, as you were talking before about the outcomes of a lot of the early days of mobile, I was thinking about how a lot of the people that were the most that I considered to be the most negative ended up being right.
That can be a bummer. I mean, yes, because you know,
there gotta be some water
if something can be used for I don't know, nefarious purposes. You know, there's someone who's going to exploit that, right?
Well, and, hold on a second, and the profit.
Yeah, I mean, and that, and, you know, that's kind of one of the drawbacks of the society that we live in, is because we've seen the potential for you to have enormous profit really quickly. With, you know, if it's a hit, you know, if you've discovered, it doesn't even need things, you know, if you have a great app, it doesn't even need to be a hit for that long for you to be, you know, in and out and wealthy beyond.
Well,
you know,
Mailbox just had that exit, yeah. Huge exit where they got bought by, Dropbox.
Yeah.
For, you know, whatever they, but they're trying, because people now are trying to get in when they see the potential and they want to get the, they want to close that up before it gets, the value gets too high.
Well, yeah, I mean, but look at what's currently getting funded now is, you know, in San Francisco, and I'm sure happening in other cities, is that, you know, Uber's come in and basically changed the way we, you know, take a cab, and, you know, in a city that has a basically kind of a crappy cab system in general, you have all these competitors coming in. It's like, what's the pink mustache? Lyft?
Yeah.
And then there's another one now, and, you know, Uber's got their own kind of Uber X, which is, you know, just people who are doing this on the side. And, you know, like that kind of, everybody's trying to jump in and get in to, you know, to where, you know, where that is. That's the big thing right now for, you know, for some of these funding rounds. You can see that model extending itself to just about anything.
Well, I'm seeing already starting to see the potential for disrupting things that have already been through a round of disruption.
Mm-hmm.
And that is just, you know, I'm just sort of starting to dig down into that and looking at how, you know, I was in New York a few weeks ago for a entrepreneur conference out there, and a lot of the people out there were into this disruption model, right? Mm-hmm. They're looking for these sort of static systems where they can come in and say, look, if I can shorten the length between the consumer and the thing that they're consuming, and I can get rid, then not only that, but not only am I making their experience getting better, but I'm getting rid of a middleman layer, mm-hmm. that was only existed a lot of times because these things had to be regulated in order to work, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Because of the financial transactions, right? So you like look at cabs, right? I mean, a lot of it is who's that guy in the front seat that I'm giving my credit card to, and mm-hmm. how am I justifying giving him that?
Mm-hmm.
But once it's through a system like Apple or some sort of trusted system, mm-hmm. then, you know, authenticated system, authentication like changes the way that a lot of these, experiences work and make them, you know, things that aren't trusted into, I mean, look at Square, right?
Yeah, I was going to say, Square is one of those quintessential examples. I mean, you talk about disruption. I mean, you've got, you know, Dorsey imagining, like, well, I mean, basically, you think about what was the core question? And I don't know him, so I don't know if this is accurate or not, but I think that it works. It's like, what if we lived in a cashless society, you know? And instead of saying, like, how do I make that happen? He just designed a device that assumed it. You know, you have, you know, now your iPad's a cash register and you don't have to shell out.
Well, I'm seeing, you know? I mean, you know, it's like in the last 2 years alone, right? Like if you were going to make something about the modern day, mm-hmm. you'd have, you put the iPad's become the point of sale.
Yeah, and it's excellent.
Right? I mean, it went from a year and a half ago to the iPad, like it's something I saw at conventions or mm-hmm. people that needed wireless, right? Mm-hmm. It's interesting, like a year and a, so the Christmas before last,
mm-hmm.
My mother has a we're not talking anything about naming, by the way, so we need,
that's
to,
okay.
I do want to get back to it though. I want to get back to it in a second, but I'll just throw out this anecdote. You know, my mother needed a radio. Mm-hmm. She's been using terrestrial radio, mm-hmm. and it was a disaster. I mean, she's older and she wants to listen to classical music, and she's being barraged for ads for adult diapers, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
I mean, and local yeah. doctors and stuff that she just doesn't care about. Especially as an older person, I mean, the amount of effort that it takes to get you to change your behavior,
mm-hmm.
and to change brand, even for something like a doctor, is monstrous. So they just, you know, if there's like four or five advertisers who are just banging on people, like hoping for that, you know, that person who just, you know, became incontinent and now they can grab them as the new brand, right? So I went to buy her a internet radio device,
mm-hmm.
and they were just gone.
Mm-hmm.
It only took me like an hour, but I sat down and it was in the back of my head and I started looking and I realized, of course they're gone because everybody's using their iPhone.
Yeah.
Right? Like the model for that business is completely evaporated because it's something the iPhone does well. So she got an iPod for Christmas,
mm-hmm.
for me, and it's all, and that's all she uses it for,
mm-hmm.
taking some photos. But, you know, slowly she might take a photograph I showed her how to do email. So she loves getting her email on there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, that's the beauty of these devices, right? Is the simplicity that they can do one thing. They do what they do very well because they're a universal interface.
Mm-hmm.
So before we completely leave the naming thing behind, I did want to come back around because mm-hmm. I think for people who listen to this, especially because I'm going to probably have a fairly large gaming audience mm-hmm. or game developer audience initially.
Yeah.
Like one thing I did want to bring up is I think it's easy for people who are making software, especially engineers and even game designers, to look at the naming of things and say, well, that's just stupid,
mm-hmm.
right? Because, you know, for them, I mean, and also because I think, and this is changing pretty rapidly now, but for the, you know, I think in the core game development especially, there was a fairly antagonistic relationship between marketing and development.
Mm, oh, absolutely, I would agree.
And I don't think you can have that relationship and create applications for mobile devices and have that kind of conflict with marketing.
Right.
So if you want, I'd love to hear a little bit, like, so where you see the name as the thin, you know, because in particular you're naming smart devices, right?
Mm-hmm.
You're naming
mm-hmm.
smartphones, you're naming tablets, fairly major ones that are going out. So one thing I'd like to talk about is, like, you know, how do you get the confidence to know that you've done a decent job and gotten something that you feel comfortable, or is it really just the client is happy?
Well, it's strange. First of all, sometimes it's difficult to know at all. I mean, you know, the nature of the client that I work for, and, you know, in the midst of the whole naming thing, because we do this with cars and we do this with companies, but with devices in general, it's more complicated than that because you're working with an equipment manufacturer and you're working with the carriers as well. And the carriers are as unique as individuals, you know. There's one, you know, one carrier can be really buttoned up and conservative, and another carrier can be, you know.
Virgin, there's only a few of them, right?
Yeah, Virgin is exactly what they say they are. They, you know, they'll take, you know, like when 4G was new, when we pitched a name for their phone, which they didn't want, but we thought, you know what, if anybody can listen to this name and listen to our rationale and actually take it seriously, they could. So we called it the Forgasm. And because, you know, 4G was brand new, and it was like, take advantage of this moment in time because soon
right.
it's all going to be 4G. And, you know, and they laughed. But, you know, had we pitched that to somebody else, to a Verizon or to an AT&T, they would have choked and they would have been like, what are we paying you for? Like, quit
right.
jerking us around, boy. You know, like, you know, it would have been nuts. But the thing is, so I'm in a really weird space these days. I think we all are if you are in that name game, because you really wonder, you know, what good does the name do anymore, right? Because I think that we're really looking at, people are getting smarter about, you know, the operating system that your device is running. They're getting more savvy to what they actually want their device to do. It's like, I want my device to be able to text, I want it to be able to do social media, and I want to have awesome screen resolution. And you can try to leverage some of those messages in the name of a device, but actually, you know, the manufacturers have some clout. You have Apple, you have HTC, you have Samsung, you have Huawei, which is starting to have a presence here, but, you know, in China for a long, long time. And those all stand for something in the consumer's mind. And, you know, you can see the shift in kind of some of the advertising that's happening between, for example, the Samsung and Apple devices, right? They're starting to position Apple as being like an old people's phone, right? And I mean, it's cool. It's tongue in cheek and everything.
No,
everything,
but I
like
mean,
that.
I'm having this discussion a lot that Apple's got a weird, the Apple interface. I mean, luckily
mm-hmm.
they've got Ives coming in to replace.
Right. Yeah.
And what's his name who left? And you know, he's got a different sense of, it's not going to be that, is it skeuomorphic?
Skeuomorphic design.
Which is good. I mean, I think, you know, I've been saying for a while, like, the big transition that I've been waiting for in design generally, right, is the design, is that we're moving away from metaphor,
mm-hmm.
right? And Google's just dived in with both feet. They're saying,
mm-hmm.
like, we're on a generation of people now who don't need it to look like a thing that it used to be.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Right? And I think that's, you know, I think, so we completely lifted off from the experience of design as metaphor.
And so that's where we get into the weirdness of naming devices, because we, you know, is it a, it's not, you know, it's not really a phone anymore, is it? I mean, it is. I mean, it makes
phone calls. I don't think it was a phone.
Phone calls, yes.
I mean, it wasn't a phone from the moment the App Store opened.
Right. And but like, it's like the one of the last things that I use my device for, right? I mean, I rarely talk on the phone, but I text and I do stuff.
I got in trouble a couple times with people who were like, you can call me. And I was like, okay, I guess, I, you know, like I had, I switched from, I mean, this was a dating thing, but I switched from, you know, I when I got married initially and I started that relationship, it was a world of phone calls.
Mm-hmm.
It was some texting. And then when I got out, of that relationship, you know, 8 years later, I was in a world of pure text, right? Mm-hmm. I thought. Mm-hmm. But like what I've had to, but I ended up having to go back, and a bunch of people are like, no, you actually need to call me at this point. Mm-hmm. Right? Like we've reached the point in this conversation where a text is not
acceptable.
It's not acceptable. Yeah. And like I had like two rounds. Like I actually had to learn that there was a point at which you actually go back, and I had so like, oh, phones aren't cool. I'm not, you know, like it's just not the way it's done.
Yeah.
And like I'd so internalized that I'd actually thrown it off. But the point is, yeah, I mean, I guess that's what you're.
It's just I wonder if there's a purpose to it anymore, and I hate that because it could put me out of a job.
Is name skeuomorphic is the question, I guess.
Right. You know, but and like, how necessary is it? Because you think about some of the there's some, you know, longer names out there because everybody wants to have a modifier on their devices too. You know, I mean, in terms of carriers and things, so you can get like, you know, the what was Sprint's device? They had like the Samsung Sprint or the Sprint Epic 4G LTE, you know, and then there was like a subline that was like a Samsung Galaxy phone or something like that, and it was just ridiculously long and ridiculously clunky. And but the name of the device is Epic, right? And that's a great name.
Right.
But like, you buried it. It's gone, and you wonder like if you have all these requirements and all these conditions that are set on there, you wonder like, okay, is it really necessary? Because you know that the consumer goes into these stores or is online and makes a decision pretty quickly, and you know, and what we don't have, or what we and you know, if I had the money, I'd commission a study on my own. Is, you know, how much does this influence your decision? How much does this influence your decision to sign another contract? You know,
I mean, I think it's price and features, don't you?
Right. So then, where do we go from there? You know, then you know, then what are we talking about? You know,
because I mean, Android, I think with Ice Cream Sandwich at least, has gotten good enough that we're looking at I look over people's Android phones and I don't see them struggling for use it
right.
anymore. And I think there's a real problem with the terms of the store and how mm-hmm. stuff's delivered, and like I've been talking to people about that. But you know, facing it as a purely interface and user experience stuff, mm-hmm. there's a lot of good stuff going on there. And I mean, I think what I'm hearing you say is like the other thing that's happening is that basically the manufacturer is becoming the de facto brand.
Yeah, and it's weird because, and it's, I mean, it's not weird.
It's fine, a lot of money into trying to break into this market,
but
right?
But that's also fine because if, you know, because that, you know, in our world and in what I do, that creates, you know, brand equity and you want that. That is something that you really want. You know, you don't want people to be invested in the Epic. You want them to be invested in, you know, the Samsung, you know, name or the HTC name if it's one, you know, like, you know, what, and you ask people like, what are you carrying, you know, what's in your purse, what's in your pocket, and people will say, I have an iPhone or I have a Samsung or I have an HTC. I've heard some exceptions to this. It's like I have a Nexus, and that is the name of the device, right?
Right.
You know? But you know, but by and large, you know, you hear, and even my father, who's like 70 years old, he refers to every device that he's had by the name of the manufacturer. So now he's, you know, he's got,
except for his, Apple, right? Apple managed to like,
well, they've got a good nomenclature system with that I going on. But like,
right.
that must have been extremely difficult to get. You know, there was a lot of money put behind that in getting that to happen.
Well, they're weird about it too, right? Like, you know, there was the new iPad, and then within 6 months of the iPad 3 being delivered, the iPad 4 was essentially out.
Mm-hmm.
And they did, it was a midstream replacement.
Mm-hmm.
And there's just, you know, I mean, and somebody was complaining about that and realized that, like, basically the MacBook has gone unnamed or rebranded. I mean, they've been doing that for almost a decade.
It is what it is. I mean, I think that if it's not broke, don't fix it, right? And I think that that's also a thing that consumers can kind of detect on their little BS sensors, right? It's like, you don't need a new name for every little single thing. And every time you do that, you draw attention to the fact that you're trying to direct your attention to this corner over here.
What do you think about Facebook Home with that rebrand?
Man, that makes me nervous.
Do you know about it?
Yeah. And you know, I'm sorry for Android users, but I mean, eventually it'll come to everything, I'm sure.
Well, not Apple, right? I mean, it'll be interesting to see what happens. Like, right? I mean, it's the ultimate revenge of the portal,
right?
But as a branded gateway,
mm-hmm.
I mean, it's interesting to see. We certainly can talk about.
I'll tell you, the first thing that came to my mind
uh-huh.
was how did you not get into a huge thing with Sony, because they have PlayStation Home.
I don't even know if that's still. alive anymore.
It's not alive, but in terms of trademark classification, those things don't die for like 3 years or so.
Mm-hmm.
So it's still there, but and if they have no intent to use, I think that they can get it. So either they threw a ton of money at it,
right?
Because when you do trademarking, really it's the major question is kind of cut and dried. Is it going to be confusing to the consumer?
So right.
So you can have a Dove bar and you can have Dove soap, you know,
right.
And they're like, well, will that be confusing? Well, if it is to you, it'll only be once. Right? But realistically, it's like, okay, I'm in two different places in the store, you know, so these things are okay. And like, I see Facebook Home and PlayStation Home being something totally different, so it's not a big deal. But, you know, but names are pieces of intellectual property, you know, they're actual assets that are protectable and that you want to protect. So it made me wonder, like, hey, you know, why, you know, how did you get this? Because it's definitely one of those things that you would want, you know, a name like Home, rather than sitting there noodling around and trying to figure out something that's totally contrived, but, you know, pretty much legally available without much of a hassle, right?
Right.
So
right.
I'm sure that this came through with, like, you know, C-level conflicts, you know, and they said, you know, you've got problems here, you know, Sony has registered this mark or something like that. And they probably just said, you know what?
Can we throw enough money and lawyers at it that we could...
Here's a bunch of money, yeah. Here's a bunch of cash, and now it's Facebook Home, which is cool.
I mean, well, okay, but so let's look at it from
totally different experiences, by the way. So there really isn't that big of an issue,
right? But
nobody's going to take it.
Nobody's confused. But now I see what you're saying. So let me ask you this question then, like, from where you're sitting with the kind of work that you do, do you feel like that's useful? Like, what we're seeing is that companies like Facebook and Google, I think,
mm-hmm.
right, are trying to brand a set of design experiences the way that we used to brand hardware,
right. Yeah,
I mean, is that?
That's fair, and those things are hard to put. They're hard to put names to. Really, they're hard to put. They're hard to describe as experiences as well. I think. I think you have the experience, but I don't think you necessarily walk away from it able to tell everybody, you know, what you had, how you felt, where it took your mind, and the proclivity to do this over and over again, right? Which is really what the hope is that this becomes part of my habit, or this becomes part of my loop. You know, I do something and I have this experience, and then I come back for more.
And that's what you're trying to capture in the naming.
Yeah, you'd like to, but, you know, names can only do a certain amount, and, you know, so you constantly go back and forth with this challenge of, look, you tell whoever it is that you're working for that, you know, your name can only do a few things, right? It can't carry a whole communications package for you. It can do, say, one or two or three things, and they all say, yes, we understand, and that's, you know, all fine and good, but you'll
get to...
They
just want that gravelly-voiced guy at the end of the commercial saying it,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, right, right, but, you know, it's like, we worked with the company, and they're like, what did they need to say? They needed to say holidays, right? And we needed to say Super Bowl, because Super Bowl was coming... You know, and we needed to say, you know, college, and we needed also to say, you know, and you're like, and do you need it to say summer and beach as well? It's like they just, and they, you know, you got these new MBA grads are trying to fill out these, you know, checklists and these
right.
Excel majors.
They've seen a couple episodes of Mad Men. They think,
yeah, and they think, and so what I get into is number one, it's like people can't believe that's, you know, somebody's paying me to do that job. But the
mistake, you get over that eventually, I hope.
Oh yeah, but then the misconception is that it's easy to do. You know, coming up with words and ideas and concepts, that's not really the difficult part. I mean, anybody could do the front end of the creative exploration that we do. The trickier part is really getting to suss out and feel who the client is and what's going to be a hit for them and how that's going to work in their space. And some of it's more political than it is actually, you know, strategic, because you need to know who you're dealing with. And, you know, well, you know, Randy's not going to go for that because, you know, his daughter was killed by a locomotive. So locomotive is not the name of this device,
yeah,
you know,
right,
or
right,
something
right,
like
right,
that.
Right, right.
But then also, like, understanding the depth of saturation within trademark classes, because a device is not like, it's not just, you know, class 28. It's, you know, it'll span five or six different classes, and that's what's happening now.
Classes of what, sorry?
Oh, sorry. Within trademark laws, there's classifications for what your thing is or what it does.
Okay.
So there's goods and services. And, you know, and the world has changed. Really, 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 really weird things have happened, because there's only a specific amount of trademark classes. And I believe that this is just a weird, interesting factoid for you. I think class 31 or 32 is transportation. And that makes very much sense. Like, okay, so we're going to brand your moving company or something like that,
right.
Or a taxi service. But guess what else lives in there? Because nobody else can figure out where it goes. cloud services, things like Dropbox.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and it's just a weird thing.
If you name your service Dropbox, you can't have a Dropbox trucking company.
Well, it would be weird because you would see if there was a Dropbox trucking company that would actually be something that would be of concern. You know, where
and you would say,
but it's not at all. You're like, look, they exist in the exact same trademark space, and somebody's filed for this, and then you can definitely justify, you know, the chance that you're going to get sued. But it's just strange because things are changing, and we have goods and services now that people just hadn't imagined, and they can't just keep building trademark classes because that's not very functional.
We're at this point where I often say this with the currency stuff, where the database systems are so much better at tracking information than the political and financial structures that we've created to actually manage it.
Mm-hmm.
Right. I don't know if I brought this up on the podcast before, but I was working on a poker, I was working on some poker products last year, and the poker games, fundamentally what they do is there's a database that can simultaneously handle up to 52 different currencies simultaneously.
Oh, wow.
Right? And that allows them to both do in-game currencies like chips,
mm-hmm.
but also manage real-world currency with the ability to put people from 5 different countries on a table together.
Oh, wow.
Right? And that's important to them because they want to keep the rooms filled, and they want to keep people grouped by things other than location, right?
Mm-hmm.
They want to find demographics that go beyond just the fact that they all live in China or whatever.
Right.
So, what you begin to realize as you delve down into these systems, especially when you look at the platforms, is that they have a lot more robust ability to manage information, both personal and financial, than governments do.
Mm.
And governments because governments have to filter everything through a system of... through this system that's designed to slow things down, designed to make, you know, for deliberation.
Right.
Right? And, mm-hmm. and you know, deliberation takes time.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Because it means that people have to argue about it and they have to talk about it. And meanwhile, you know, you have Reddit where people are upvoting 1,000 times a second.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's disruptive change on a fundamental level from top to bottom.
It's interesting, you know, the point, you know, that you make about, you know, disruptive change and disrupting disruption sometimes is that, what I'm seeing is like just different classes of people kind of emerge from this. And there's people who are really comfortable with this. But even though it feels pretty chaotic, it's certainly not existing in like, it's not an accepted business model. Like you can't just have chaos. You know, that's no good for business, right?
Right.
But we're finding that, you know, if we pair ourselves with like real good data metrics and we can learn and quantify the things that we want to know, then being disruptive is not necessarily a very bad thing. It's actually quite a good thing. But
in the long run,
in the
sure.
long run. And then there's people who are more traditionalists who are just, and they're all uncomfortable with it. And it would be very easy for me to just classify them as like, old white guys in suits or codgers or people who are behind the times. But that's actually not the truth. The thing is, like, there's a lot of us. I mean, even me and me a lot of the time in certain capacities who are really trying to get our heads around what is going on.
It's just impossible.
And my dad, it's funny because my father thinks that there should be a system to this, and that I get it in some way that he doesn't. Like there's a missing manual, or he was absent for one day of news and now he's off, you know, or something like
right,
that.
Right.
And I have to keep explaining it to him, like, look, man, you know, I don't quite know either, you know, but I do think we have to push this button, you know,
well,
and
friend,
go
my
and
friend,
do it.
My friend Rushkoff, and I think I brought this up. I'm going to probably bring this up on the podcast until he shows up on the podcast. But but he just wrote a book called Present Shock, which the fundamental premise of is that there's more information happening at any moment than anyone can grasp or put into any kind of context anymore.
Yeah.
Right? And that you have to give up this idea of narrative that we used to have and put it into the structure of revelation.
Mm-hmm.
Right? That it's just the act of learning is the choices that you're making.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot more to it than that. But he's come up with all these different syndromes for it, apocalypto, and anyway, but you know the different syndromes of it. But the interesting point of it is that like once you recognize it, like I have friends who are 24 and 25 who are telling me that they feel old because they can't keep track of everything anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
it's like, dude, I mean, it's no longer a demarcation of being lost in the amount of information that's going on is no longer a demarcation of age.
Yeah, not at
like,
all.
It's like, I actually feel kind of free. Like, it's interesting because like, I think when we grew up, it was, right? Mm-hmm. It's like get off my lawn joke is partially like, you don't know what's going on. You don't know the new lingo. You don't know the new thing. But like, you know, a meme can be happening for weeks, and because somebody has decided that's not their tribal affiliation or that's not what they're into, they're not able to go on to that meme. There was a whole thing on 4th of July on Reddit where they had a joke that Reddit had been bought by Valve and that they were going to turn Reddit into Team Fortress.
Oh, cool.
And so all the jokes
were... That'd be awesome if it was true.
Yeah, right? So they started like... But, you know, everybody ran with it. But then like half the time on every big major post, there was somebody's like, what is going on here? Like all day long, right? Because it was like people like just... You just can't... You know, it's like there's no... The zeitgeist is... There's, you know, it's like the end of... It's like the end of Ghostbusters, right? Like the force field's been turned off and all the zeitgeists are escaping from the from the containment field at the same time, right? There's no commonality. And I think, you know, the outcome is and I think this is part of the I mean, I'd be interested to hear we're getting a little low on time. Oh yeah, we're hitting the end. But like you know, the idea of naming and the idea is like, are you trying to at least contain some sense of understanding within the context of the devices that people are choosing to use, if you can reach them, if you can get them.
Yeah, that's kind of like the fence that I sit on. Because part of me wants to be, you know, future forward and kind of think ahead and just say, you know what, you know, this is going to go away, and or you know, it's not going to be a person like me anymore. This won't be a discipline anymore, right? This is, you know, maybe it'll just. Maybe everybody's going to name their devices on their own. You know, maybe that'll be something, a part of the personalization plan, and you get to call your thing whatever it is, and it, you know, that's cool. But, you know, or something else. Or maybe it just goes away entirely, and because we're not interested in it anymore, and it doesn't make us feel, you know, more inclined to purchase it, or more inclined to be loyal to an HTC or an AT&T or anybody, and maybe that goes away. And then, you know, maybe what's next is what we're talking about when you talk about these experiences that we're having. And you know, I don't know that naming is necessarily one of those things that's going to, you know, live forever in the context of, you know, this technology.
Right.
You mentioned really early on, and I think that where the opportunities actually are as we see these, you know, as we see manufacturers, I mean, even Apple is part of this now, creating kind of ecosystems of their own, right? Where all, because these things, sensors and cameras and things are all going to start talking to each other, you know? And like, people don't realize that, you know, like, you know, I go to Korea for other, you know, other types of client, but it's interesting because you'll see air conditioners on the outside of buildings, right? And they're Samsung, right? And the fridges are Samsung, you know, that guy who did Gangnam Style is like the spokesperson for the fridge. He's on all the commercials and stuff, Psy. And you know that at some point in time, your phone is going to talk to your TV, is going to talk to your fridge, you know, and like, you know, my joke with my father is it's like, you know, it's going to call my doctor when I finish that jar of mayonnaise, you know, because, you know, my insurance premiums are going to go up. But like, but those ecosystems are something that I think they could probably stand to be called something, number one. And I don't necessarily mean it's something that you need to go ahead and sell. But I think that when people realize that they're going to have this seamless, unified experience, either A, you're going to want it because it's going to create a very convenient and easier life for you to live. And we just have less and less time to fiddle around with stuff. And like, the act of being alive and doing the things that we need to do is pretty important. And if we're taken up by dealing with our, you know, the smart hub menu and all, you know, all this other crap, instead of just being able to punch a button on our phones or something.
Well, that, I mean, we didn't get a chance to get into it because you were talking before we were hoping, you know, if we had a little more time, we were going to talk about some of the maker culture and some of your interest in that stuff. But I think, you know, to just touch on that in a minute or two, the, you know, real world devices, right? And this whole push that Google's making for simplicity, I think what we're seeing is the diminishment between the interface and the activity, right? And the next step after we go away from metaphors is saying, can we create objects that the interface is not a metaphor for anything? It's a better way of interacting to get a result. Or the next step beyond that, it's a better way of interacting to do something we've never done before.
Right?
And we're starting to see that kind of interface design. I mean, I think that was a big, you know, I still haven't completely parsed out, but the big failure of Apple to move Maps over, right? And Google came in with a much more elegant interface. Although, you know, the Google Maps interface has got some really, it's very, it's a, one of the first interfaces I've seen that's been rolled out that way with like where the level of usability over confusion is pretty high.
Mm-hmm.
That you have to dig through it a lot before you, like I can't hand the Maps app, the Google Maps phone to somebody who's mm-hmm. never used it before and have them find something without having them ask me a question about how to use it.
Right.
And it's like the response really is just poke at the buttons. There's not that many to choose from. You'll mm-hmm. get the experience that you want to have.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that Google's willing to go to a more complicated experience out of the box
mm-hmm.
and leave behind that,
mm-hmm.
It better be really easy to use and it better handhold you all the way through or nobody's mm-hmm. going to use it. It's like, you know, it's like now it's a little more like, well, if you really want to know where you're going, you really want the good experience with all the good data we have, you're gonna buck up and do it our way. And mm-hmm. you know what? Our way's going to be okay.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to trust us a little bit, which, you know, I don't know, it's an interesting question. And so, to your point, though, I mean, so who owns that experience? Who brands that experience? How that comes together?
Well, I think, you know, the other thing that's going on now is we see the people, you know, I think that, you know, Google doesn't like it when you use the word Google as a verb, right?
To Google something,
yeah,
sure.
So, it's actually a problem in trademarking, right? Because it's called genericide, and if you do it enough, then you don't
get... It was a Xerox thing, right? Back in the
Xerox,
day.
Xerox, Kleenex, Band-Aid, like, yeah.
It becomes the name of the thing rather than the name of the product.
You lose the rights to be able to protect it.
Right.
So, you know, it's like everybody's hand me a Kleenex instead of hand me a tissue, and Kleenex can be any brand of tissue, right? So Google has some rules about how you talk about, you know, I used the Google search engine to find... You know, they have, like, rules for journalists and things like that. I don't know that they're all followed, but I think that the people will people, you know, grabbed onto that and it was convenient, and now Googling something is a word, it's a phrase, it's an activity, and it's an experience. And maybe that experience of creating this more, you know, in the instance of Maps, is a little bit more complicated but a lot better, you know, end result. Maybe it's called Googleizing something, you know. You know what I mean? But
right.
I think the people have a lot more power in choosing what that's called, because I think in the same way that, like, architects won't put pavement into campuses and business campuses, you know, they'll let people walk on them for like a month and see what paths naturally form, because it's beautiful that way, right?
Right.
And so I think that sometimes, and I think that's, you know, in the same way that happens with language as well. We start to call it the thing that makes the most sense and that everybody kind of, intrinsically gets. Okay, you know, you Googleized it. That means that I've got some learning to do, but I will get what I want out of the thing.
Right.
Or you could say they Appleized it, or they did something else.
It's interesting
that's
something
that's going to happen.
We haven't reached a point where Facebook is enough of an activity as a verb,
mm-hmm.
and I like to kick on Facebook occasionally,
mm-hmm.
Where they couldn't get around.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not a Facebook. It's not the Facebook portal, or
mm-hmm.
it's not. You know, it's not Facebook on your phone. It's they had to call it home. They had
mm-hmm.
to rebrand it. I see this with Microsoft a lot,
mm-hmm.
right? It's like
mm-hmm.
it's like they're trying to be so all encompassing. They don't really have a center or a core experience that it's built around.
Well, there's a certain hollowness to it, right? And you know, and that's, again, like, we need to look at, like, how some of those companies are organized and the divisions and things. Because when you look at it from, you know, the outsider's perspective, you can instantly see, like, I can tell you what's wrong with that in like five sentences, right? But the fact is, when you get into these organizations that have thousands of people and divisions that don't talk to one another
mm-hmm.
or have their own political situations,
right.
you see why, you know, how on earth could a Hotmail exist in an Outlook.com, and then, you know, you have these products that, and nothing feels like they're, you know, they're harmoniously synergized.
I mean, when they bought Hotmail, right, they tried to put it on Apple servers. This was like 98. And,
yeah.
And they had to shut it down because it broke, and they had to bring it back to Apache for
yeah.
a couple years. So, Jason, we're hitting an hour. We're well over an hour.
Okay, cool.
It's been a great conversation.
Yeah.
Thanks for coming. I mean, I think, you know, just generally, I mean, I was excited to talk to you because I think that this is a different way of looking at stuff. And again, I think people can underestimate the power of small things
mm-hmm.
in what they're making. I'm sorry we didn't have a chance to go broader, nerd out a little bit and talk about some other stuff.
We can another time. You
yeah,
know,
yeah, yeah.
I think that part of this is that, you know, I realize that you speak from the gaming field and
but
that
I want
discipline.
This the goal of this podcast is not to stay there. The goal of us is to look at interactive entertainment and design as a discipline.
Yeah, so we need to, but people on my side need to start bridging that gap more and more often and need to have a better grasp of it. And getting in the mix there, and because, you know, I'm a person who enjoys gaming as well, And being able to kind of bridge that and start having these kind of discussions, I think it's just a kind of a good cross-pollination, so I really appreciate you having me.
Thank you.
And that brings us to the end of this week's Active Design Podcast. Thanks very much for listening. Thanks to Jason Bice for being on. Thanks to Yacht for providing the music. And if you want to leave a message or find out more about me, you can email me at andrew@andrewpmayer.com, or you can just check out www.andrewpmayer.com. We'll be back next week with another podcast and another guest. Thanks very much. Bye-bye.